From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we go to Moscow to speak with analyst Mark Sloboda, basically updating our conversation begun last week about the rather unusual situation in and around Ukraine and I'd say the borders of Russia in general in the European sphere in any event. Mark, welcome.
Don, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR.
It's our pleasure and our honor also. I guess we'll start with today's Pentagon pronouncement that Russia may not be poised to invade Ukraine after all, after, I don't know, weeks of the press here in the U.S. telling us that any minute now. And that seems to follow by hours some dissent among European capital people, some of the leaders in Europe, from Biden's statement that they were all on the same page while he was striking a rather bellicose tone also at a press conference yesterday, although he wouldn't allow himself to be questioned, saying, you people are going to ask me about Russia, so I'm not taking any questions. But John Kirby actually was the one delivering at the Pentagon briefing on Monday that we're mindful of what the Russians can do, but so we're not there yet. And so anyway, but he did also say that the Russians have no intention of de-escalating, which is pretty interesting because last I knew, Russia proposed like a security structure, a simple one, with each NATO and the U.S. On the 17th of December, saying basically, look, everybody pull back from our borders and we can all go back to work and make money. I don't know, maybe give us a little bit lay of the land.
Yeah, I mean, Russia's demands in their security guarantee draft treaties that they sent to the U.S. And to NATO, respectively, they're maximalist demands, right? And it's not clear whether they were meant to be a first tough position in a protracted negotiation, which they would then compromise down from, or whether they were meant, knowing that they would be completely dismissed, they couldn't be met, and that they were simply presenting that as kind of an initial casus belli, a just cause for war, that these demands were refused both internationally and domestically. But what they were actually asking for is pretty expansive, because first and foremost, it's that NATO not expand any further eastwards, particularly not into Ukraine and Georgia. Not will not do it for 10 years, not will not do it for 20 years, but it won't happen.
Right.
And that would cause NATO to have to retreat from their 2008 statement that they said Ukraine and Georgia will one day join NATO. And it has to be remembered that at the time, 20% of the Ukrainian population wanted to join NATO. So, this was obviously geopolitically forecasting what they were going to do by hook or crook.
Right.
That's the first thing, right? No further NATO expansion eastwards. And that is already the no starter, but that's kind of the principal Russian demand. The second demand is that the U.S. forced its client state in Kiev to finally fulfill the Minsk Accords as written. No renegotiation of them, that they fulfill the Minsk Accords. And that would actually solve the first one. They're interrelated, because part of that is granting federalization to Ukraine in the Constitution, changing the Constitution, and thus giving a type of autonomy to the Donbass and possibly other regions of Ukraine if they wanted to as well, like say West Ukraine. But that would then that would creating a Bosnia-Herzegovina type scenario where that would allow the Donbass to basically veto any future attempt by Ukraine, the federal state, to enter into NATO. Or it must be said, and vice versa. It would Finlandize Ukraine, right? It would say Ukraine can't join NATO and the EU, and NATO and Ukraine can't join the CSTO and the Eurasian Union either, right? It would declare Ukraine officially neutral. And again, try to balance their own domestic politics between East and West, which is really kind of the only future for them without, you know, continued civil conflict of one form or another. And there were other demands, though. One is that NATO forces, particularly what they're concerned about is the U.S. and U.K., should not have troops stationed in countries past Germany, Poland, Romania, the Baltics, and so on, and that Russia and the United States and NATO cease their ever larger and more frequent military exercises on Russia's borders or, you know, in the waters immediately off their coast in the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea. And Russia promises to reciprocate, at least on the naval front. But of course, that's not really a threat anyway, because it's hardly the case that Russian ships are conducting freedom of navigation exercises in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
So these are pretty expansive demands, and there was really no hope of them being met anyway. But it's interesting, these statements by the Pentagon, it can be made a little bit much out of them. What they were saying is they do not see an imminent intervention. That could mean it's possible that we could see one in 2 weeks. There's no news but they do notice that there is still a lot of troops moving around in Russia and Russian troops to Belarus, if not directly on the Ukrainian border, definitely in Western Russia, which is to say that Russia is creating a force posture away from the front lines that could certainly allow for an intervention in very short order, something that would be seen. Right, you can't hide these kind of things any more than the U.S. could hide, the military buildup to go into Iraq in 2003. You can't hide this sort of thing, because of modern satellites and
right.
reconnaissance and spy planes and everything. It would be seen. But again, the Russian military has been tasked with coming up with a range of military options to take Russia's security into their own hands. And one of them is the possibility the extreme end is an intervention in Ukraine. And they have created various scenarios for that. And they are putting stuff into position in Western Russia without it necessarily being right on the Ukrainian border. Ukrainians have more troops on the border and have had them there for some time than Russia has. They have some 125,000 plus on the border, and that means right on the Donbass. And this is where it gets interesting, because there are also increasing signs that Ukraine is moving an increasing amount of meaning the Kiev regime is moving a increasing amount of heavy military equipment as well. And that includes not only tanks and artillery, but it includes minesweeping vehicles. Now, minesweeping vehicles would have no purpose whatsoever in a defensive action, right, for a presumed Russian intervention into Ukraine. They are for an offensive on the Donbass. And here we have some very interesting statements out of Zelensky just yesterday. He was speaking to his domestic intelligence services, and he said that we have learned how to fight back against foreign aggression effectively enough. I am convinced that now is the time to move on to offensive action to protect our national interests. And then a little bit later, he went on to say, our citizens are united by the goal of returning our territory, meaning the Donbass and the Crimea. And that is some very provocative statements, because he's specifically talking about offensive action and retaking Donbass and Crimea, not through any type of political reconciliation or anything like that, but obviously by offensive action. And that is crazy provocative going on while the West is screaming about a looming, if not imminent, Russian military intervention in Ukraine. And it has to be noted that the Ukrainian government is actually really downplaying to their own people the possibility of at least an imminent Russian military thing. There is a Ukrainian security think tank, the Center for Security, that has put out an analysis in the last 24 hours. And this is disputed by Western, particularly American military analysts on Russia. But they say they don't see an invasion coming anytime soon at all. They don't see it in the cards. I'm not sure I agree myself with everything they said. But there's no question that the Ukrainian government is telling its people not to panic, and that they don't see any real change in the Russian force composition right on their borders. Now, of course, they have a domestic,
right,
priority to prevent panic, to right. prevent panic buying, to prevent people fleeing, who might want to flee the country, to have, the effect on the economy and larger than that. But it's rather, and at the same time, the EU and France are also making statements that they don't see any type of imminent military action by Russia either, and that there's still time to de-escalate all of this.
Right.
Whereas the U.S. and the U.K. press and the governments, of course, because they're really just stenographers for them, are just nonstop 24/7. The evil Vladimir Putin himself is about to destroy Ukraine in person. Like yesterday, it's pretty an insane level of one-sided propaganda without any serious critical analysis of it. In fact, repeatedly, I have seen the West's own serious military analysts saying these people are off their rockers. You guys need to calm down and say serious. Because you are preventing us from giving real analysis of the situation, and it's not helping the situation for anyone, because of the way that Congress and the executive branch and the media, the fourth estate, all feed back on each other in these feedback loops of increasing reactionary statements and movement.
Yeah, I saw a tweet of yours yesterday, maybe recently, last couple of days, on exactly that point, to say, not for nothing, you might be inclined to dismiss the press here just because it's obvious that what they're saying is insane, but they are actually players in this. They don't call them the fourth estate for nothing, I think is what you said. They actually have an impact on events.
Yeah, and they have an agenda. They have an ideology. They have a worldview. And evidently, they have their own geopolitics as well. And I think that, the dominant strain in the U.S. media is that they get very angry. They have become so used to the untrammeled, hegemonic, the unipolar moment of U.S. hegemony in the 1990s and the early 2000s that they themselves get very angry when it is challenged or not acted on, and they often seek to belittle and push presidents. If you take a look at the opprobrium that was heaped on Joe Biden for the pullout from Afghanistan, not just for the way that it happened, but that it happened at
right,
all.
The fact of it.
And that was by a lot of the supposedly liberal media as well.
Yeah.
And you know, there's no question it could have been handled better. It has to be noted that Trump tried to pull out and was prevented by his own military administration. And if things had been actually put into motion when he said so back then, it might not have been so frantic and unorganized. But you know, if they're even attacking Joe Biden when he doesn't act hegemonic leader of free, consider it, the media will even go after him.
Yeah. So, you know, there are a couple things that I want to parse here a little bit. One is, you know, I've been looking at, you know this, we've sort of discussed this both on and off mic, sort of following, and last week, particularly the meeting between Blinken and Lavrov and the way it was played in the press and all of that, it echoed to me in my more paranoid moments that we're about to have a war, the meeting between von Ribbentrop and the German foreign minister and Molotov, the Soviet foreign minister in 1939, that resulted, you know, that preceded about by less than 2 years, the actual invasion of the Soviet Union by the Germans under Operation Barbarossa. I've been looking at maps, which is something that I like to do out of my background in the title business. And I keep noticing that if you were to look at a map.
Who doesn't love to look at historical maps?
Say again?
Who doesn't love to look at historical maps?
Yeah, yeah, historical and present.
You're not a true history or security or international relations geek unless you totally geek out over looking at that.
Because it's about land, and a lot of almost all of this is about that, or takes place on it, one or the other. So I'm looking at a current map of NATO, the enlargement map. Wikipedia, they have one with the dates color-coded. And then I'm looking at Operation Barbarossa at its fullest expression, and then I'm keeping in mind that you had almost color revolutions in both Belarus and Kazakhstan. And I'm saying to myself, if I were a Russian military planner, I sure as hell would have a lot of resources deployed to the border there, because this is like they came in already and conquered what Hitler had conquered, more or less, at least as far as he was able to administer. And they're starting from there this time, and they got a lot more stuff.
It's simple geography, right? There is one long flat plain stretching between Western Russia and Europe, more or less, and that it is between the upper northern swamps of Belarus and the Baltics, which are more difficult terrain. And you know, the further south you start to you're running into the Black Sea.
Right.
There's this corridor, and it has been used repeatedly in history, you know, both by the more frequent Western, historically speaking, military incursions in Russia, whether we're talking Charles the Great, whether we're talking Peter the Great, whether we're talking Napoleon, whether we're talking Hitler, you know, that is the route, the Polish during the years of the pretenders that Poland installed in Russia. And when Russia has reacted backwards the other way, right, of course, it has followed the same path.
Yeah.
And that is simply where, you know, geography really comes into, international relations and makes it geopolitics. That corridor is always going to be used because ultimately you have to move land forces. Russia is a giant land power,
right?
That is the corridor that must be used.
My point is most of it has already been captured.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the big things that Russia has always relied on is strategic depth. space between powerful European countries, whether that was Germany or Napoleon or anything else, and itself. And the fact that they could take time to organize. And remember, Russia has such a large country that
they can run all the way to the Pacific. They can run almost all the way to Alaska.
Right to Alaska. But they have to have time to organize, to pull forces together.
Right.
So they trade land for time.
Right.
And that is has historically always been the way that Russia has had to defend itself. And it has worked repeatedly. And when they see that strategic depth, whether that space is neutral territory or Russia's own territory taken away, they'd prefer the former. They'd settle for the latter. But when it is in hostile hands and that strategic depth is completely gone, then Russian military planners, they're planning for contingencies.
Yeah.
And when they see NATO military forces, I mean, they're not worried about the military forces of Bulgaria or Poland or Romania or the Baltics, but they're worried about U.S. and to a lesser extent British as a sidekick military forces on their borders. And when they see that happen and the strategic depth gone, they get extremely nervous.
This is what drives this. So now another aspect to that, I think I've discussed this with you before, and I'm you're probably familiar with this situation also. I took a train from then Leningrad in 1990 to Warsaw. And when we got to the frontier between Soviet Union and Poland, we had to get off the train, and they lifted the car we were in and all the other cars in our train up off the carriage with a big crane and put it on a carriage on another track next to it that went from there into Poland. And that track was of a different gauge than the one that we had just left. And that was apparently designed in order to make it difficult for invaders to carry whatever they wanted to by rail without an extra step to slow them down and perhaps be vulnerable to a defensive attack. We have a situation now instead where that kind of infrastructure is being built in the Baltics and apparently in Ukraine and such, which moves the game forward even more.
Yeah, railroad gauge is a big thing because, of course, when you're considering the movement of troops across such incredible distances and have to consider all kinds of weather, railroads are actually an important thing, right? By necessity. More so historically than now, but still now.
Right.
And there was a different railroad gauge between the West and the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. Yep. And there still is between Russia and, between Europe. And actually that was, I've talked before about how comprehensive the EU association agreement for Ukraine was, these thousands of pages that was more comprehensive than any other association agreement has ever been, that were designed to destroy every bit of the economy, the bureaucracy, the legal structure of Ukraine down to the ground and rebuild it all in the EU's image, something that was so destructive and so costly and everything that Yanukovych, who had lobbied for it, actually had to turn it down. But one of those items was that Ukraine needs to get rid of all of its railroad track and replace it with a railroad track gauge applicable, for the EU. And that is a type of infrastructure that lends itself to politics, hence geopolitics, right? Yeah. And it's a lot harder, not only to use military troops, but it makes economics more difficult as well. And even simple travel, as in your case.
On that, I'm glad you made that last little reference to economics. Something that sort of displays the absurdity of the current situation and also the highly militaristic characteristic of it is the fact that if you were to take a train where I live in metropolitan New York, okay, and then take a train in Moscow and then take a train in Beijing, The comparison is here, you know, the infrastructure is you know, like 19th century practically. You know, they've got cars that they built 10, 5 years ago or whatever, but the entire thing was built a long time ago. We don't go 150 miles an hour on our trains. We're lucky if we go 50. And if you look at the subways in Moscow, for example, compared to the subways in New York, it's laughable. People constantly post memes that live in New York City about it. So for the U.S. or the EU to be dictating to any former part of the Soviet Union exactly what kind of rail traffic they should carry, it really is laughable.
Yeah, it is. It really is. You've brought up, you know, Germany and Berlin a couple times here, and there's been an, you know, it kind of in the background of this whole crisis and tensions, there's a few interesting things going on. And one of it is a lot of splits and cracks are starting to appear in NATO.
Yeah.
In Europe. And France has we've had Macron speak out himself recently about the need to de-escalate and to start a dialogue with Russia. And you've had it's a political season. We're coming up on elections in France, and there are contenders for Macron's seat, and they are calling for much more. They're actually calling for we've had some of them. We have had Eric Zemmour,
yes,
who is running for politics. He's calling for France to get out of under the U.S. you know, geopolitical thumb,
yep,
and to restore relations with Russia, because yep, he says that,
yeah, undue sanctions and everything. Yeah,
yeah, the path that the U.S. is on, he says, is geopolitically destructive, and they want off that train. So you've got a lot of that going on. You have had Germany, with the new government there led by the SPD, Olaf Scholz, and he has declined to send lethal military aid weapons to Ukraine, as the UK and the US and other countries are doing. Not only that, but he forced prevented the Baltic states from sending weapons that Germany had provided to them onto Ukraine.
Right.
And when the UK has been making this, you know, quite a few weapons deliveries just in recent days to Kiev, to Ukraine. Some of them were going to Western Ukraine, to Lvov, but they had to fly around German airspace. Evidently, Germany yeah, wasn't providing them the airspace. And there's a lot of recriminations, a lot of nasty memes, how
finger points,
Berlin
all kind,
is
yeah,
betraying
yeah,
Ukraine and all of this. And at the same time, there was the head of the German Navy was just in a big scandal. He was speaking in India.
Right.
And he was arguing,
for peace, basically. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. He was arguing, first of all, that actually the West should be trying. He was a little weird because he was speaking from actually a Christian sense.
Right.
And that Russia as a Christian, which really rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah.
But he was saying that the West should be trying to get Russia on board to ally against China, and you know, good luck with
right,
that.
Right.
But he was also saying, you know, kind of breaking that, you know, Crimea is never coming back to Ukraine. It doesn't
yep,
want to come back
right,
to Ukraine.
That's right.
And also that he was stressing it a little bit too much, this idea that Putin wants respect.
Right.
Right. That is the motivator. I don't believe that's not.
I don't. It's look. When you're dealing with lunacy, we're pretty much yeah, out of time. But when you're dealing with lunacy, sometimes you have to use the language of the nut for the nut yeah, to understand you. And so, you know, when you frame the bottom line of what he was saying, which is, I think, the part that was so offensive, is that rather than going into a conflict over this or risking it or even slumping our chests, people ought to be thinking about what's going on and slowing it down. And we got to stop here. And
he was forced to resign.
And he was forced to resign. Major yes, naval officer. All right, we're out of time. So we'll speak with you again next great, week about this, Mark. Hopefully we'll all be here, and thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.